everyone, welcome to The Gifted Place, a professional learning community for gifted education. I'm your host, Sonu Aziz. Joining us today is Dr. Matthew Fugate, a nationally regarded educator in the field of gifted education and twice exceptionality. Dr. Fugate is provost at Bridges Graduate School of Cognitive Diversity and Education and serves on the Texas Association for Gifted and Talented Board and as chair of the Special Populations Network for the National Association for Gifted Children. He also serves on the editorial board for the Journal for Education of the Gifted and is the associate editor of Teaching for High Potential. Welcome, Dr. Matthew Fugate.
Hi, thank you for having me today, Sonu. It's so good to be here with you.
I had the pleasure of chatting with many of your colleagues at Bridges, Dr. Baum, Dr. Lim, and Dr. Tetrol. All wonderful conversations with so many great insights into Twice Exceptional. So it's interesting because I connected with you through Texas Association for Gene. So can you share how you connect with both organizations?
Sure. Well, with Bridges, I serve as the provost and chief academic officer. I am currently on the board, as you stated. I'm currently secretary of the board for the Texas Association for Gifted and Talented, and will next year step into the role of president-elect for the association. So it's really an honor to be able to serve both associations that have such strong goals and missions towards advocacy for our gifted students, and especially our twice exceptional students.
Can you share a little bit about how you got interested in 2E?
So really, 2E and gifted both, like many of us that get into this field, it happened by accident. I was a teacher. I remember teaching was actually a second career for me. I started out in the business world and I went into education. And my first year teaching, one of my mentors happened to be the gifted coordinator for our school. Mm-hmm. And in observing me, she's like, "Boy, you work. I love the way you work and your approach. And I think you'd be really great for teaching in our gifted program," which at that point was an after school program. "Would you consider it?" And I said, "Sure, you know." And working through there, then she eventually got me to the University of Connecticut, where I did my master's in gifted education. And that first summer of my three summers program is where I met Marcia Gentry, who began actively recruiting me to come to Purdue to pursue my doctorate. And it was during those experiences that I started really understanding the unique differences and the diversity of our gifted population, particularly our students who are gifted with special needs. And so it was really powerful. I had one student in particular who really, really put me on the path. I knew working with him at that point, I started working with him as the gifted coordinator at the school I was in. And so I started working with him in kindergarten and realized, okay, this is something all new for me. And that was really my introduction into understanding twice exceptionality. You know, before that, it had been a subject we had talked about, but really my first interaction with a truly 2E kid that I was aware of. And that's a whole nother issue. And I knew then, I was like, okay, I've got to know more. And it ignited a passion in me that continues today.
And you've made such a great impact. ADHD is often viewed as a deficit. And the CDC defines ADHD as one of the most common neurodevelopmental disorders of childhood. In the classroom, students with ADHD may have trouble paying attention, controlling impulsive behaviors, and having a hard time being at rest. In 2016, you wrote a moving piece based on your earlier research that suggests a connection between ADHD and creativity. And can you share a bit about the second grade student that made an impact on you?
Yeah, so that second grade student I actually was referencing, I first encountered him when he was in kindergarten. It's the same student. And so, but I was teaching second grade. I was the gifted coordinator for the school. I started working with Michael when he was in kindergarten, when he was identified. Quickly became clear that this was a 2E child. And so I had worked with Michael. By then we had when I came into the coordinator's position, I moved to a pullout program in this school. So I had been working with him in kindergarten, in first grade, and was excited to have him in my classroom in second grade. And I remember there was one day, Michael was one of these really, you know, the typical 2E kid, right? Incredibly gifted, high verbal abilities. He was one of those kids you could just have this conversation with, and the conversations were on such an advanced level that you'd sometimes forget he was like a kid, right? And so, and you know, he had the quirky sense of humor, all of that. But the other challenging issues for him were starting to bubble to the surface. And there was a lot of impulsivity. Became clear that they're eventually diagnosed with dyslexia, and it started to play a toll on his self-esteem. And one day he came into my classroom, and he walked in, and was early in the morning. He was the first one there, and he put his stuff away, and I could tell something was off. So I let him get settled, and then I just went and sat down at the table next to him, and I said, you know, Michael, is everything okay? Is there anything you want to talk about? You seem like something's bothering you today. And he looked at me and he said, Mr. Fugate, I'm stupid. And that was soul crushing for me. And so I had to take a breath. I cry at Hallmark commercials, so you know that was setting off the tear ducts. I just looked at him. I said, Michael, why would you ever say that? I said, I've been working with you since kindergarten. I promise you, you are anything but stupid. You are not stupid. And he looked at me and he says, but I can't read. Everybody else in the class can read but me. And this is where being able to have those types of conversations with him was really a benefit. And I just looked at him. I said, you're right. You can't read, right? You've been diagnosed with dyslexia. So that makes the skill of reading more challenging for you. But here's what I'm going to promise you right now. I'm never going to assess you or give you a grade based on whether or not you can read words on a page. You're going to work with our dyslexia specialist. We're going to practice strategies. She's going to work with you on strategies. We're going to practice them in the classroom. Here's what I care about. Do you understand the story? Plain and simple, right? We can get the words off the page for you. Do you understand the story? I was a reading language arts teacher. And it changed the conversation because I knew what his comprehension level was. It was through the roof. And so let's take away the stigma of what he couldn't do and focus on what he could do very, very well. And that was really just, it was a game changer. He had already been identified as a student who would most likely fail the third grade state assessment in reading. And I remember fast forwarding to spring of the following year, having a very excited Michael running into my classroom. He had gotten the results of his reading, tax reading state assessment, and he had passed on the first time attempt. It had been modified to meet his needs. His reading language arts teacher that year, I had started working with her actually when he was in my second grade classroom. Had already identified we need to make sure Michael goes into this classroom. So she and I had already started collaborating together and really sharing ideas about this is how I've been working. These are things that work. This is what doesn't work. And she was able to take that and expand upon it when he was in third grade. And here's a kid who wasn't supposed to pass the state assessment, and he got it on the first attempt. It was, and the look of joy and excitement on his face that day was just worth every bit. I might have cried again.
But tears of joy.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah.
Do you remember the strategies that you may have used at the time with him so that he could demonstrate that he was understanding? Because teachers sometimes get, you know, just they get focused on just, you know, one specific way that they'd like students to be able to demonstrate that. Was there anything that you remember specifically?
It was really about giving him, and it wasn't just Michael. This was how I worked with my students, but choice. You know, we get teachers, and especially in our recent history, have become so focused on the test. And because of accountability measures that have been set up, feel like the only way that they can appropriately work with the students is to teach to that test. My philosophy was forget the test and just focus on, okay, what are your strengths? Where are your strength areas? Oral comprehension was a huge strength area. Creativity for Michael was a huge strength area. I remember there was I would do this 9-week project with the students, and it was focused on building their research skills. It was tied to social studies, and Michael had picked his topic area, and for their final product, they could do whatever they wanted. I gave them ideas. You know, they could do a report. They could give a presentation. One of the options was to create a game. And Michael created a game. Now, he was fascinated with, you know, like Arthurian legend type things, you know, knights and kings and queens. And there were always, you know, there was invariably a dragon involved somewhere. And this was his project. His research project was focused on the history of the Gulf Coast region of Texas. His game included knights and kings, right? It didn't necessarily have anything, but all of his quiz cards were around the research that he had developed. And we always did a gallery walk and invited other classes to come in and see the things that the students created. And that day, Michael's game was the most popular project. Kids were lining up to play it multiple times, right? He was a rock star. So it was really the strategy was to focus on his strength areas and give him that choice to explore and really tap into his own creativity. And so, yeah, if I could get every teacher to do that across the country, I would love it. I would be so happy.
Can you provide some context around ADHD and working memory and how it connects to creativity?
Yeah. So, you know, just in layman's term, this idea of working memory is the ability to hold something in mind just long enough to carry out a task. In those of us with ADHD, that working memory ability is much lower than our neurotypical peers. But tied to that is this idea of lowered latent inhibition. Right. And latent inhibition is this ability to weed out unnecessary information, mm-hmm. to be able to focus only on what is relevant for the task at hand. Well, with the lowered working memory comes a lowered ability of latent inhibition. I always look at it as students who are neurotypical are able to put their blinders on their peripheral. Right. And block out and focus solely on what's in front of them. Kids with ADHD, those blinders are left wide open. Right. And so all of this information is flowing in constantly. But it's that lowered latent inhibition that may be connected to higher levels of creative thinking and creative thinking ability, because that those ideas are those all that stimuli is constantly flowing in and creating all this thought pattern. And so, you know, and there have been studies that have shown that this correlation between lowered latent inhibition and creative thinking ability and higher levels of creativity. And so it's really fascinating to see. And again, highlights the strength of the student versus coming at it from a deficit perspective.
I can imagine how if there's so much information coming in the way you're describing it, that sometimes it can be distracting for a student. So are there any strategies that you can suggest for teachers to use so that the child is still being productive?
So again, I'm going to go back to offering, making sure that we're giving students opportunity for choice, choice in what they're learning, how they're learning, and how they're demonstrating that learning. I will say sometimes we need to remember that as teachers, although there are times when that instruction needs to be didactic, teacher to student, the majority of the time, if we focus on being as teachers as facilitators of learning rather than givers of knowledge, being there to support students, and when we're honed in and are aware of their interests and strengths, kids, including our ADHD kids, will be more focused and on task when it's in an area of strength, and they'll be more willing to take academic risks, right? Sydney Zental, who was one of my advisors, was one of the first researchers in ADHD started this work back in the 70s. And at that time, the idea was that, well, ADHD students don't know how to focus. They can't focus, right? They're overstimulated. She was really the first to posit this idea that says, no, it's not that they're overstimulated, it's that they're inappropriately stimulated. They're being put into these classrooms where they're being told what to learn, how to learn, without taking into account their interests and their strengths. And so what if we did that? And then we see, you know, I would say, have you seen the kid with ADHD who is so intently involved, you know, quote unquote, hyper-focused? I don't like that term, but for now, we'll stick with that. Hyper-focused on an activity, then the challenge becomes transitioning them to something else, right? Because they're so intently focused. So we've got to make sure that we're looking at students' interests and we're building learning experiences that are targeted towards those interest areas so that we can help those students maintain that time on task.
For students with low working memory, performing on exams can be challenging. So aside from increasing time as an accommodation, how can we rethink formal assessments and standardized tests to include space for the creativity or even choice?
Yeah, one of the unfortunate truths of our current public school system are those standardized tests, right? There's not a lot we can do with those. But those are problematic even for our neurotypical students. Mm-hmm. I had a gifted student who was identified, was not 2E. And I remember on a state assessment, it was the reading comprehension test, which is the longest in that assessment that we were giving. It was the Stanford 10 assessment battery. And 5 minutes in, he raised his hand. And I walked over and I was prepared to say what you're instructed to say, just do the best you can, right? Because you can't really answer any questions. And he looked at me, he goes, I'm done. And I said, what? He said, I'm done. And I looked at the Scantron and sure enough, all the bubbles in that section, you know, every line had a bubble filled in. I said, all I could do was say, okay, put your sheet in your test booklet, close it. And he did. And then he reached under his desk and pulled out the Harry Potter novel he was reading. That's what he wanted to read, right? So the standardized tests are problematic. The best thing to do is for our ADHD students and our twice exceptional students is to give them opportunities to practice leading up to the test. You know, in my classroom, the chairs and the tables were like accessories because on a normal day of learning, you had kids over here on beanbags, you had kids under desks on carpet squares, you had kids over in the library, you had kids at the computer all day long, right? Productivity was the focus in that environment. But we would have to take, I would always set aside time to say, okay, this is a time where we need to be in our seats at our table so that we could practice those skills. And then, you know, making sure that our kids with ADHD have those fidgets or things on that are available to them, so that when they're need that time to express their energy, they've got something on hand. Formalized assessments that are part of the curriculum or part of the day-to-day operations of a classroom, I would encourage teachers to step away from the pencil and paper based assessment. It doesn't always have to be pencil and paper based. It can be performance based. Change our idea of what that assessment looks like, and providing an opportunity for these students to again express their learning in a way that follows their strength areas.
And I think what's interesting is that even though there's a lot of data out there in the classroom, there's still a fixed mindset around the way we view children with ADHD. And the focus tends to be on behaviors that are maybe too negative. So what can we do to reset educators' perceptions of students with ADHD so that there's more opportunities for recognizing creativity and these positive attributes of ADHD?
We really have to get out there and provide opportunities for professional learning and growth for our educators. The old adage, we teach the way we were taught. And I think there has, been this idea that so much focus on deficit, on the way a student with ADHD behaves, versus a focus on understanding that these kids come with a story that includes a lot of things we don't see in the classroom. And so it's our responsibility as teachers to learn that story, understand who they are outside the four walls of the classroom. One of the first homework assignments I would always give my class on the first day, and it would be for their parents. And I would say, write me a letter. Tell me about your child. I want to hear all the great things that your child does that I don't get to see because it's outside the classroom. I'd have about anywhere from an 80 to 100% response rate every year with those letters. And that was valuable information because I started to see, okay, here are things that I can incorporate into the classroom, into the learning experiences for all of my kids. And so really just changing our mindset and stop looking at how do we fix a child with ADHD to how do we identify their strengths and their interests and use that as a tool to help them mitigate some of the challenges that they face and provide them with pathways to learning and growth and achievement in our classrooms.
And often, I think in classrooms, the rate limiting factors to instructional differentiation is limited class time and really how much of it goes to reinforcing classroom norms, especially when you do have students with ADHD who, kind of disrupt the class the way the teachers, if they're in the middle of a lesson. Sometimes class size or achieving a curriculum goal can also be a barrier. So educators often opt for this one size fits all approach to teaching a lesson because they're trying to race to get to the end of the day, in their lessons, but they kind of do that for all of it. How does that affect the self-esteem and creativity of outliers?
It's detrimental. These kids don't fit in a one size fits all curriculum. I use when I do presentations, I have a little cartoon that I show, and it's at the window of the quote unquote complaint department at a department store. And the customer service agent in the window says, when we said one size fits all, we didn't mean all at the same time. And you see three guys stuffed into a sweater trying to make it fit at the same time, right? When we have teachers who are teaching to the middle, which is what a one size fits all is, that you're doing a disservice to kids on both ends of the spectrum. Those kids who are high achieving, those kids who are struggling. And so that leaves the majority of your classroom not having their needs met. And so again, it's important that as district leaders, as school leaders and administrators, that time for professional learning, and not just professional development, right? Professional development is someone like me comes in for an hour, says, does their spiel. Half the people are listening. The other half are grading papers because that's time. And then I go away and there's no accountability, no follow through, no follow up. Professional learning is this sustained, ongoing professional development that can occur in schools through book studies, through mentoring programs, through times for teachers to go in and observe one another. That's where we see focus on, okay, how do identifying that teacher in the school who somehow differentiates to meet the needs of their kids in the same time of day. We've all got the same time of day in that classroom, right? So if you've got a teacher who's struggling with that time management and is just going to the middle, we need to make sure that as school leadership is saying, here, let's mentor and support you and provide you with opportunities for a teacher to come in and model a lesson in your classroom, for you to go and see a teacher in their classroom so that we can build those skills. Because if we don't do that, then we as leaders are only teaching to the middle of our teaching population. So we've got to differentiate our professional learning.
Can you share what the current guidelines in Texas look like for gifted education?
So in Texas, we follow what's called the Texas State Plan for Gifted and Talented Education. And so what the state plan does is it lays out a foundational level of accountability for gifted programs. And then what an exemplary program of this standard, what would above and beyond look like? And so in Texas, for identification and service for gifted students is mandated by the state. However, what those identification procedures look like and what the services look like are left up to the local education agency. So each district can have a different way that they identify students. So some may use a matrix system, some may use a portfolio-based system, some may use a combination of multiple measures. So that's left up to individual districts to identify and determine. And then once students are identified, what those services look like can vary from district to district or school to school.
Do you think that the variations that exist in being able to identify the students plays a role in how students are identified?
Yes, most definitely. I actually just had this conversation with my students in my doctoral seminar. I have them do research paper presentations, and one of them was doing this presentation, and it was focused on services. It was a fantastic, phenomenal presentation. But I brought up this question. I said, you know, services are important, but they're only one part of the conversation. We have to look at how we are identifying students. We have to make sure that the ways we're identifying are equitable and open access for students, and that those identification measures match the programs of services that we're offering. And so we have to go back and look at how we're identifying kids. And that means taking a hard look at missing this data that exists in our schools and in our districts. You know, who are those kids? We're not matching up our demographics of our students. When you look at the inverse levels of identification across just race and ethnicity of students identified for gifted services versus students who are identified for special education services, it's stark, right? It's almost a direct inverse across each of the race and ethnicity breakdowns populations. And so we've got to start looking at how we're identifying kids. And if our, and be willing to say, if we're not identifying, if we've got kids who are missing from our gifted programs and services, then we've got to change, got to look at our identification and be willing to say, okay, this isn't working. We've got to change how we're identifying until we find the right combination. And it does have to be a multiple measures approach. And I am a strong proponent and advocate of the or rule versus the and rule when we're talking about multiple measures. Multiple measures follows the and rule. Multiple pathways follows the or rule, saying, you know, so a multiple measures would be, okay, you have to score at a certain level on this assessment and on this assessment and on this assessment, versus multiple pathways that say, okay, you can be identified following portfolio approach, or you may be identified following this multiple measures approach, or you may be identified through some performance-based assessment, right? That opens up the opportunity for schools to really identify those students, those twice exceptional students that they're not getting through more traditional measures of identification.
Yeah, and I think I can see how if you have a standardized approach or like the and approach, how you're saying there'll definitely be some students that will fall under the radar that may not show up. So even in the example of Michael, maybe he wouldn't have shown up on a reading test, but if you give him a different alternative, he would have shown up somewhere.
Yeah. So I will tell you one of the great things with Michael is in our district, we did a universal assessment for gifted and talented for every kindergartner in the district. And those assessments looked a little bit different and were suited for where Michael was at that time. So he was easily identified. That his 2E challenges didn't start to bubble to the surface until about first grade. And that's when those differences really started to become apparent. And we knew, okay, we've got to change our approach in how we're working with him in the classroom.
Is there value in getting tested more than once over a span of time? So I know like if students come in kindergarten, that's usually an entry point where they'll get tested. Is there any value in doing it again, maybe in third or fourth grade?
So in Texas, one of the standards for exemplary programming is allowing students to have that opportunity to where, okay, maybe you weren't identified in kindergarten, but you can be referred and be tested again in first grade or in second grade or in third grade, right? And there is, when we think about from a talent development approach aspect, offering talent development opportunities for all of our students can be through differentiation, through the use of enrichment clusters and in schools. That gives an opportunity for students to want, again, identify strength interest areas, offer those opportunities for that just-in-time teaching of skills that helps them develop those talents and those interests, and then be able to assess again for entry into our gifted programs.
A lot of the initial assessment, I would imagine, is coming from a teacher's observations. So it would be important for teachers to be trained in recognizing the traits that could be considered 2E or gifted. So what does training look like for teachers?
In Texas specifically?
In Texas.
In Texas, where teachers are to be able to work with students who are gifted and for those students to be coded as identified and served, a teacher has to have 30 clock hours of professional development in nature and needs. And then every year have a minimum of 6 hours updates in those areas. And so in that, includes training focused specifically on twice exceptional learners. Those clock hour credits can also come from conferences. So TAGT every summer hosts the Gifted Plus Equity Conf that is focused specifically on 2E and underserved populations within gifted education. So we have a huge response of educators who use that conference to get that additional as part of their 6-hour update and to get that additional growth and learning in those areas of the needs of our underserved and 2E populations.
What's one thing educators can do in their classroom tomorrow to shift towards a more inclusive environment that not only accepts, but more importantly, helps encourage students with ADHD to help develop their creativity?
Give an interest assessment to your students. You can find them online. You may have tools in your classroom. Get to know where their strengths and interests are. And then use that information to guide your planning of your learning experiences in your classroom. You know, I know everyone, again, it's easy to say, you know, forget the test, but you've got to forget the test. Mm-hmm. And provide learning experiences where those skills can be introduced that are going to be assessed, but can be introduced in a way that the students will be focused on and have the time to learn those skills when they need them in a real world setting. Bring in problem-based learning into your classroom. Invite students to have a choice in their assessment. Make sure you're maintaining high expectations for all your students, not the same expectations, but know where each student is and set a goal, an expectation for them to help them stretch, give them the support they need. And when they hit that expectation, celebrate and raise it again, right? That's what we've got to do. That's where we focus on a strength-based approach versus a deficit approach to education.
Great strategies. You have a unique perspective on ADHD. You refer to it as ADHG. Can you share what that stands for and what it means? Because the message behind it's so powerful.
Yeah. So when I was at Purdue, I was working with twice exceptional gifted students with ADHD and came up with the term attention divergent hyperactive giftedness with the goal of taking the deficiency and the deficit out of the conversation, right? Attention divergent, right? All these varied interests, these strengths, hyperactive giftedness, that excitement of being this gifted child, that puts the focus on the student being gifted first, right? That's where we have to keep our focus. Yes, they have challenges, but if we focus on their strengths, again, we can use those to help support the challenges that they face and to help them build the skills they need to address those challenges. It changes the whole conversation. I am a bad special educator. I don't like the terms deficiency or deficit or learning disability. By focusing on attention divergent hyperactive giftedness, we take the focus off of that what a child can't do. And again, bring it back to what can they do and how can I make the most of that in my classroom to make sure students are getting the support they need to develop their talents and skills. It's about changing a paradigm shift and recognizing all the wonderful potential that exists within our 2E students.
So inspirational. So great chatting with you, Dr. Fugate. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. I've enjoyed our conversation today.
Dr. Fugate's book, Understanding Twice Exceptional Learners, Connecting Research to Practice, is published by Routledge and offers an in-depth look at the needs and lived experiences of students who are twice exceptional. You can find the book on Amazon. Thank you for listening and for being part of the Gifted Place learning community.